think you'll agree with me that Pepper Hamilton and the Middle East Forum make a very, very good combination. And in fact, you all are part of that combination, and I, on behalf of the firm and my partners and associates, it's a pleasure for me to welcome you to another one of the Middle East Forum presentations. It looks like we have a stellar and good-sized crowd today, and I attribute that to our speaker, and I will introduce him in just one moment. But since I do see some folks here that look like perhaps they are new or first-timers to the Middle East Forum, I just want to tell you a little bit about the forum. For 10 years now, in fact, for more than 10 years now, the forum has been a really outstanding voice for democratic governments in the Middle East. It has chronicled and questioned and presented information over the years through its website, which I invite you to visit. There are actually four of them now, and we can give you information on that. Through its quarterly, which is a leading scholarly publication, in whose pages are some of the major worldwide experts on the Middle East, and a copy of which is delivered to all of our elected representatives in Congress, I'm told. So the Middle East Forum has been doing great work, and I want to urge everyone here who has not already become a member to become a member. And I want to read to you something that Charles Krauthammer said in one of his newspaper columns. He said, during the decades when America slept, Dan Pipes, who is our well-known and well-known to most of you director, Dan Pipes was among the very first to understand the dangers of Islamic radicalism. In his many writings, he identified it, explained its roots, including most notably Wahhabism, as practiced and promoted by Saudi Arabia. And Dan Pipes warned of its plans to infiltrate and make war on the United States itself. That is Mr. Krauthammer in his National Distributed column. Now, the Middle East Forum staff provides me with speeches which are too long and too eloquent for me to deliver, and there is a line here which even I, as the minister and promoter of the Middle East Forum, am a little bit sheepish to read, but I do want to read it to you because I think it shows you at least the position that Dan Pipes and the Middle East Forum hold. This is from the Boston Globe. And the Globe wrote that had the world heeded Dan Pipes' warnings, September 11th would never have happened. So enough of a commercial. I'm going to circulate a Middle East Forum sign-up list. If we don't already have you on here, please think seriously and give us your name and your email, and we'll make sure that you keep getting this good information. Let me ask you also, I love to do this because this always happens when I'm at a show or something. Someone comes out and says, sign off your cell phone. So now I'm getting a chance to do it. So if you have a cell phone or a pager, please, out of respect for the others and for our speaker, turn it off. We're going to now have 20 minutes or so of what I think you'll find to be a fascinating presentation. And after that, Ronnie Stillman will conduct a question and answer period, so I'll ask you to hold your questions until that time. So let me just say a word or two about Daniel Mandel, who is seated to my right. He is, and has been since December, our associate director here at the Middle East Forum. I think when he opens his mouth, you'll be able to know, if you don't already know, that he joined us from Australia. And he has his PhD in 1999 from the University of Melbourne, and he's done some teaching there. He's also been the recipient of a number of awards and grants, some of which have gone toward the writing and publication of his new book, which is H.V. Evitz and the Establishment of Israel, the Undercover Zionist, and he'll be talking about that today. And I want you to know that we have some advanced British copies of it, and they're available for sale outside. After you hear this speech, I'm sure you're going to want to know more and look at some of these interesting pictures and documents. It will also be published, I understand, in the not-too-distant future in an American edition, but if you want to be the first one to your block and so forth and so on, you can do it outside here. I can say that David Price Jones, who I think is a well-known person that many of you have read or know about, said of this book that this study of the enigmatic Evett, who I understand was the president of the General Assembly at or around the time of the birth of Israel and its admission to the UN, that this study of the enigmatic Evett reveals the fascinating and vital role of personality in the shadowy art of international diplomacy. So that's a little flavor of what we're going to hear about. It goes without saying that Dr. Mandel is widely published. His articles have appeared all around the world. They're in journals, they're in newspapers. He's often quoted in the press. He's on the radio and TV programs as a commentator. And I'll ask you to join me in giving him a warm welcome and
thank you very much for that introduction. And ladies and gentlemen, can everybody hear? Can everybody hear me now?
Okay, just stand up.
See how we
stand up.
Yes, it will be that. We'll try that. Very glad to see you all today, and I'm honored to discuss my recently published book, which should be out in the UK in a week or two, and in about 2 or 3 weeks in an American edition over here, so you won't have to deal with colors spelled O-U-R at the end of the few doctoral dissertations get published, and that's largely because they're very theoretical and they have jargon and graphs and all these sort of things, which in my opinion don't belong in a book. Perhaps the book's about mathematics or biology, yes, but I believe history, the indispensable part of history, that should tell a story. Preferably an interesting story than an important one. And in that sense, I'm proud to have written the book because it's a story about an event that, the creation of the State of Israel and an event that basically transformed the history of the Middle East and over the course of history. And it's looked at from a peculiar angle of vision, and that's why you're going to look around and say, who is this character H.B. Evett? I've never heard of him. Or I don't know what he did, and then why was he so crucial? This is the thing, I'm pursuing this story at a certain angle of vision. It's basically what one man did at a crucial moment, when there was a particular combination of circumstances where things were very finely balanced and could have gone one way or the other. I once interviewed the British historian Paul Johnson, who told me about his historical training under a famed Oxford historian called A.J.P. Taylor. Maybe the name means something to some people here. He wrote a very controversial book on the origins of the Second World War, and in fact, it was the subject of my undergraduate thesis. So I was fascinated when he said he'd studied under Taylor, and he said that Taylor once said to him, it's actually no use writing a big scholarly term if it's just going to sit on the bookshelf gathering dust. It has to be read for years and years to come. And Taylor was lucky because his books remained in print for quite some time. And as for books about theory and in place of people and a story, he said that's just history with the history left out. So this book is not like that. This is a story, and in that sense I trust will be interesting to its readers. Now, applied to the Middle East, Taylor's words have a very spooky kind of accuracy, because the idea of history with the history left out is very much the problem with Middle Eastern studies today. I know of no other area of historical scholarship where the standards have been so debased, where the partisanship is so rampant, and where the corruption of academic standards is a bit more flagrant. And in the case of my own book, which is about how Israel slipped into existence, I tell the story based on the archives in Australia, the papers of Evett, which are kept in Adelaide, the British archives. I was here, I did research in Maryland at the American archives, and in Britain and in Israel and the United Nations. So it is based on the papers. It tells the story as I found it to be, and of course I have my opinions, and not everyone will necessarily agree with them. But I think the sources are there, and the facts are there on which people can make their own judgment. But I try and tell the story as accurately as I found it. Now, we're talking, of course, of Israel's emergence at a crucial moment in history when people thought it had very, very little chance of coming into existence. The British, in early 1947, handed over the question of Palestine. They were administering Palestine for the previous 30 years. They handed it over to the United Nations out of desperation. They'd basically given up. They didn't know what to do with the country and to do with the competing war between the Arabs and Jews and between themselves and their sides. And they didn't actually expect a decision in favor of partition. They really didn't quite know. They probably thought the UN would give it back to them and say, you can do what you like, and that would have suited them. It was a time in which, in 1947, there were 1.2 million Arabs living in Palestine and 650,000 Jews. But decisively, over the previous 30 years, the British had both helped and hindered the building of a Jewish state pursuant to the Balfour Declaration of 1917, in which Britain had pledged to support the upbuilding of not of a Jewish state, but of a Jewish national home. But here you had a country, a conflict, which had emerged, and there seemed to be no solution. And others had tried to come along and solve it, and no one had come up with a solution that both sides had accepted, and certainly no solution that anyone had been able to put into effect. So now it was the UN's turn, a very new organization, which had only been around since 1945. It was untested, and there were a lot, in those days there was a lot of hope that this was an organization that might actually be able to do something. Eppert was a major figure in the life of the UN. He was one of the architects of the United Nations Charter. He had been very busy at the San Francisco conference. He made a name for himself there. The New York Times wrote him a very friendly editorial saying he was the outstanding figure of the conference, in fact. And he had been responsible for much of the United Nations Charter as it then existed. He was a major figure in Australia before coming to the UN. He was, at the age of 36, he became the youngest justice of the High Court of Australia, which is the equivalent of the US Supreme Court. At the age of 36, no one has done that before or since. And he's had 10 years on the High Court before entering politics. Most people, I understand, are the other way around. He went into politics, and it's almost straight into government when the Labour Party in Australia came into office just before Pearl Harbor. And he was Attorney General and what was then, in those days, called Minister for External Affairs. And in that role, he played a great role on the international stage at San Francisco. And he was a person, however, who was very difficult to work with, and by the way, very, very difficult to research, because he covered up his tracks. He didn't leave a record, he didn't keep a diary, there was no diary of his to go through, he didn't confide his thoughts to letters, he wasn't a big correspondent. He didn't trust his colleagues, because he was a paranoid man, so he had formed friendships in politics. All his friends, close friends, were from outside politics. He wouldn't get close enough to anyone. And he was very difficult to deal with. People who worked under him found him a nightmare. Several very distinguished diplomats, one of them later became the Australian Foreign Minister, resigned on his watch, refused to work with him, couldn't work with him. People who he didn't like or he thought were in some way a threat, he would send them off to some different posting in like an Ottawa or somewhere like that. And so he was obstinate, he was suspicious, he was distrustful, he had a streak of paranoia, he sought the limelight. He was thoroughly unpopular even with people who were on the same side, like Canada's Lester Pearson. Thought he was a very smart chap, but that was just a bit too difficult to deal with. General MacArthur liked him, but said, you know, but he shifts his position quite a lot, doesn't he? So he was, in short, he was brilliant but erratic. Let me quote you actually a tribute to from his peers, because they are quite amusing. The British ambassador to the UN, Sir Alexander Cadogan, who was, by the way, a big opponent of Zionism as well, he says, and you can imagine him saying, he says, Eppert the Australian, who's the most practical man in the world, he makes long and tiresome speeches on every conceivable subject, always advocating the wrong thing, and generally with a view to being inconvenient and offensive to us, and boosting himself. And Upper Eben, of course, the Israel's first UN ambassador, he always had an unsparing depiction of his colleagues, and he said this: his self-confidence was absolute. Behind his abrasive exterior lurks an abrasive interior. He never allowed his resolution to be blunted by any confession of infallibility. He was a contentious man. He did not suffer fools, or for that matter, wise men, gladly. He expected deference and was seldom inclined to regard any praise of himself as excessive. There was always a danger that some injury to his vanity or sense of hierarchy might provoke vindictive reaction. So a very prickly gentleman indeed. And by the way, the State Department, they used to write official records and profiles of people they dealt with. They've said that although he has been accused of self-seeking, even to the point of intellectual dishonesty, it appears to be difficult to decide in some instances whether Mr. Evatt is motivated by patriotism or simply by egoism. So, and he has been accused of behaving like the Prime Minister of Australia already and of showing signs of megalomania. It was this unpredictable man who ended up playing a decisive part in the events that changed the course of history and led basically the creation of Israel. Why he did so is a matter I discussed in the book. I basically devoted a chapter to trying to work out how he came to be in this position. And by the way, people have reached different conclusions on his behavior was so equivocal at times. He was so shifty, and he was sometimes so non-committal that people actually said, well, actually, he was opposed to Zionism. And at least one scholar came to the conclusion that he was pro-Arab, which is actually, well, technically not possible because, like a lot of Australians of his generation, he didn't really much like the Arabs. So he kept, as I said, no records to make it clear what he was thinking at any given time. And he used to engineer people he trusted into positions of power so he could relate to them directly and bypass lines of communication. So he, for example, plucked a friend of his, not a diplomat at all. He was in fact an artist, an Australian artist, the man who painted the first Australian abstract painting, actually, a man called Sam Attia. And he put him in diplomacy. The man spoke good French as well, which was handy in diplomacy in those days. And he sent him off on missions here and there. He would tell him to open safes at embassies when no one was looking, just to see what other people were doing. He spied on his own diplomats, and through this man who wasn't even officially a bureaucrat. Abio was a cosmopolitan. He was a socialist. He called his interest in politics politicking, so he played it like a game. He loved to ruffle the feathers of the very proper and stuffy diplomats. A few years ago I spoke to the late Sir Harold Bealey in London. Bealey was the most important advisor to the British Foreign Secretary at the time on Palestine, Ernest Bevin, who was a great opponent to Zionism, and so was Bealey. And in recollecting Evatt, he said he had this young man, I've forgotten his name, and I told him it was Abad. Yes, that's it. And he used to have the coarsest exchanges with him. He would start swearing in the middle of a conversation. He once had a lift with him in the car, and he was just totally appalled at what he had seen. And Winston Churchill, by the way, thought that Abad was the rudest man and most foul-mouthed diplomat he had ever met. Evatt trusted Attia, however, and he trusted him like no one else, and since Attia had a good friend among the diplomats, a man called John Hood, if he wanted something sensitive to be dealt with, where they would report directly to him and not to the department, he would put them on the spot. So it was Attia and Hood who became the people who handled Palestine for Evatt, the subject of which he didn't want to very well know what he was about. We still don't know, however, exactly why Evatt decided that he would perhaps do something for the Zionist movement. There is at least one of his critics said, we'll never know the truth about this because he systematically covered his tracks. And when I started to research this, I was a bit unlucky because it so happened that both Hood and Attia had died only the year before. They'd been both very good friends throughout their life. They'd later retired to the south of France and grown grapes there with their respective wives. And so they died within a year of each other, about a year before I started researching. So I thought, well, I've lost the best evidence there is. But it is actually possible to work out what they were up to. First, and also some of the influences there, but there were a couple of Zionist leaders in Australia, one in particular who became a close friend of his and tried to get some commitment from him. Evatt kept saying, no, I won't do commitment, I'll answer in deeds, not in words. And he kept repeating that formula. So they always were suspicious, what does he really mean? Is he really going to be of any help? There was one of the leading international legal authorities of the day was actually based in Sydney University in those days, a man called Julius Stone. And he was a very ardent Zionist, and he tried to impress upon Evatt the importance of supporting Zionism and how it was consistent with international law and so on. But he might have overestimated the amount of influence he had on Evatt. In my view, one of the biggest influences on Evatt, and this question was his American friend, Frieda Kirschway, the editor of The Nation magazine. Now, it may surprise you today to know that The Nation magazine then was the most ardent champion of Zionism. It's a completely different publication today, and we cannot imagine what she would have thought of that. She wouldn't have recognized it today. She was not Jewish, but she was very determined that Zionism was the right answer to the problems of Palestine at the time, and she impressed upon a lot of leaders, and Ebert met with her every time he was in New York. And she was quite confident that he would support Zionism. And as I say, the UN turned over, the British turned over Palestine to the UN early in 1947, and the UN was reluctant to deal with it. So what did they do? They put together an investigative committee of 11 nations to go to Palestine and decide to investigate the problem, seek all three sides, the British being the third, and come up with a solution. There were 11 nations, Australia was one of them. And at the end of this investigation, it voted 7-3 in favor of partitioning the country into an Arab state and into a Jewish state. Three nations voted in favor of a federal Arab state in which the Arab population would have predominated, and one nation abstained, Australia. Australia refused to commit itself to that state. The reason was Ebert was basically holding out later in the year to become president of the UN General Assembly, and he was not about to alienate the 5 votes of the Arab League. He lost that vote, but he got a consolation prize. It was what's called the Ad Hoc Committee on the Palestinian Question. When the UN Investigating Committee came back to this recommendation of partition, this committee had to decide basically what to recommend to the Assembly, and Ebert chaired that committee for 2 months. He was subjected to all sorts of pressures to change candidates, to swap subcommittees around and so on. He was promising, meanwhile, the Arabs that they would do better with him as president over Palestine. He put an appeal to go out there and say that, while at the same time he was saying he wasn't going to let down the Zionists. The Americans had the State Department involved, and the State Department was trying to torpedo partition. And eventually Ebert put in line with a plan of theirs, which was to have partition moved to a subcommittee so the pro-Arab scheme could be considered. So he said, yes, let's have a subcommittee of each. And the Zionists were appalled. They thought, this is going to sink the idea. Didn't have any such effect at all, because what actually happened was that, therefore, all the Arab nations and their supporters worked on their plan in their little subcommittee, and the Committee on Partition worked uninstructed, uninterrupted, and put together a very detailed plan, which Ebert, at the end, was able to recommend to the Assembly. He insisted they come to a vote before the end of the session in 1947. The Arabs lost the vote in the subcommittee. They even tried to have the whole question of Palestine referred to the International Court of Justice, and the committee had to vote on that. The vote, 21 against 20. The Australia, it was the vote of Ebert sitting as chairman that knocked out that consideration, and partition went ahead to the Assembly. And as you all know, 29th of November 1947, the UN General Assembly voted in favor of partition by a vote of 33-13 with 10 abstentions. And this was, if you like, Israel's warrant for status. So this was a historic moment. You can always ask the question, of course, well, what if it would happen if the vote had gone the other way? Or what if the UN hadn't voted at all? Well, a few things can be said. Firstly, the vote had to happen then, or it wouldn't have passed at all. Had the work at Ebert's committee not reported and recommended by the end of 47, the Cold War was emerging between the superpowers. This was the last time they cooperated on anything for many years to come. And if no UN decision had been reached, probably none would have been reached at all. The whole thing would have been thrown back into the pot to be reconstituted. There probably would have been another committee. Everyone believes that in the international circumstances of the time, there probably would never have been a vote for a partition. Well, that's not controversial, but some people have argued, well, okay, let's say there wasn't a vote for partition. What would have happened? The British would have left Palestine anyway. The Arabs and Jews would have fought it out pretty much as they did. And Israel would probably have emerged pretty much as it did within the borders it came to occupy in 1949. But that's not really true. Because had there not been a vote for partition, America and the Soviet Union may not have supported its emergence at all. And this support was crucial at the time. Now, true, the Soviet Union and America don't necessarily do what the United Nations say, and we would say today, nor should they necessarily, but the point is, without that resolution, without that support of the Assembly, the route for Soviet support of Israel and for American support, on easy terms, would have been blocked. And both countries had good reasons to support the other side. In America, it was so finely balanced. President Truman was up against his Defense Secretary, James Forrestal. He was up against General Marshall, the Secretary of State, the oil lobby. None of the diplomats in the State Department who dealt with the Near East were in favor of Zionism. And it was only President Truman who in the end decided that he would support partition. And had he not done so, he would have called for death himself, of course, for the role of the course of history. And would he have done so when things were so finely balanced and there had been no votes for partition, or partition had been voted down? Chances are not. History is the story of opportunities, and once they're lost, they're not likely to recur. So it is an important event which allowed Israel to slip into existence, because you had a continuum in which there was no Jewish state, there had been no international decision in favor of one. You had a Soviet Union that was fiercely anti-Zionist the whole time. Stalin remained anti-Zionist, suppressing the Jews and the Zionist movement at the time, but he supported Israel because he wanted Britain out of the Middle East at the time. All of these things could change. It was a moment in history, and Israel slipped in that very slender moment. There were to be reverses. I won't go into the whole story. There were to be reverses along the way, because once partition was through, it was actually the United States that sought to frustrate it and put an international trusteeship over Palestine, and it was clear that the Arabs were going to go to war. This was defeated partly with Ebert's help, but it was touch and go right up until the moment on the 15th of May 1948, when the British High Commissioner left Jerusalem and the British forces departed. The State of Israel was declared. Tel Aviv was bombed from the air by Egyptian aircraft, and the first prime ministerial address to the new country was delivered by David Ben-Gurion from an air raid shelter. So that wasn't the end, by the way, of Ebert's involvement in the affairs of Israel and the conflict there. He fought very hard also for Israel to be admitted into the United Nations, and there was a great opposition to that. The British were very opposed. They were unhappy that Israel had emerged in a way they hadn't expected. They tried to prevent the entire British Commonwealth from recognizing the new state, and they succeeded for a number of months in preventing even Australia recognizing the new country. And recognition is a very important thing when a country is young and untested and hasn't got many official friends. But Ebert, as lately became president of the General Assembly, the second time he tried in 1948, he actually presided and worked for Israel's admission, and that occurred in the last week of his presidency in March 49. I'll leave you with one other riddle of Dr. Ebert that he left the world at the time. You all know today that Jerusalem remains a very contentious issue, and that whenever there is discussions on peace, this came up to Camp David four years ago now. People sometimes try to revive the idea of Jerusalem being internationalized. What's the origin of this idea that Jerusalem should be internationalized? A city, you know, with a large Jewish majority, the only city in the world, by the way, with a Jewish majority since the 1880s, should be internationalized. It's actually this man's fault. He did that, even though he was a supporter of Zionism. And the reason he did it was for domestic politics. Australia has a very large Catholic population. It was a very important population in terms of his own party, the Labour Party. I think there were 21 cabinet ministers in Australia at the time. 13 of them were Catholic. And the Vatican took a very strong line that Jerusalem had to be internationalized. They had a lot of arcane considerations involved, but chiefly the main one was they wanted to guarantee the rights and liberties of the churches in Jerusalem. But beyond that, they didn't want it really to be in either Muslim hands or Jewish hands. And at the end of the day, though, if it had to be one, they preferred Muslim rather than Jewish. And they weren't very strong in every country, especially the Catholic countries, for support, and indeed the Catholic countries felt under pressure to support internationalizing the city. Well, internationalization was part of the original partition plan. Ebert had seen to that, because he wasn't going to alienate the Jewish vote. Now, he understood that this scheme probably didn't necessarily make a lot of practical sense. It would have been very costly and expensive. It would have been very hard to implement. And what's more, the war had taken place, and the city was now divided between Israel and Transjordan. And most powers didn't want to evacuate the city. So you actually had Israel and Transjordan, or Jordan by that stage, it was called, collaborating to frustrate the idea of internationalizing the city. And yet Ebert was pushing for it. He was committed on the record. He met with the Israelis at times. The Israelis by this stage had representation in Australia, and they kept trying to argue against internationalization, and he actually said to them something like, "Don't be afraid of this word internationalization. It all just matters how much authority Israel gets in the territory it actually wants." That was vague. He seems to be suggesting that he'll go along with a scheme that maybe on paper internationalizing the city, but in reality Israel will not lose control. In fact, that's not the kind of scheme that arrived at the UN. the Catholic Church came down very much against the idea of what was called limited internationalism. They wanted a complete, total international regime for the city. And Ebert was drawing a lot of criticism from Catholic quarters in Australia for being seen to be weak on internationalization. But he felt the need to push it. He came up, as he was a devious man, with a very devious scheme, which was to have a resolution put forward at the UN by Australia calling for internationalization. And it was a full regime of internationalization, but he put in a very subtle clause calling for the whole thing to be reviewed in 12 months' time by an international committee. And there was a lot of reluctance to go along with this. It's reasonable to think that he would have been seen to be pushing internationalization, but in reality it wouldn't happen. But there was a comedy of errors. It was the Australian resolution that was voted on, but not before it had been amended by other powers when they took out that part. And because Australia, a non-Catholic country, was seen to be pushing what the Vatican wanted, none of the Catholic countries felt that they could really oppose the internationalization scheme. So the result is, although Britain wasn't in favor, although Israel wasn't in favor, Jordan wasn't in favor, the United States wasn't in favor, it nonetheless passed in the General Assembly. And to this day, you ever hear people talking about the idea that the UN called for internationalization of Jerusalem in 1949, it's due to this man. So he left an indelible mark on the region. But why don't I probably stop there and maybe we can take questions.
May I exercise my prerogative as Q&A moderator and just ask you what HB stands? We have AJP Taylor. What is HB?
AJP Taylor is Ellen John Percival Taylor.
I know, and HB.
HB Everett is Herbert Veer Everett. V-E-R-E. Good name for a dog, isn't it?
I'd love to get in as many people as possible. Anyone like to lead off with a question? No. I usually have the opposite problem. Ken, forgive me if I don't know your name, please.
Very cool. I was wondering why the Soviet Union has spread and mentioned something attractive. And obviously that Britain and the Soviet Union would have been in favor of anything to do with British out. Were there other motives there? Obviously, I think the Soviet Union would have been interested in the oil, so they go the other way. I just want to generally ask that question.
There was an emerging Cold War. The Soviet Union was interesting in subverting pro-American regimes in the region, and already in the 50s they were busy with Iran and so on. But they couldn't get to Saudi Arabia. The Americans had that set up already. But their chief concern was of the moment. Stalin, of course, was a strongly paranoid totalitarian dictator. He hadn't moved on a massive scale against the Jews until his last years, until really roughly around this time. It was when he was doing these things in the Soviet Union, including the show trial later before he died, the doctor's plot, which many historians take as being a prelude maybe to a massive pogrom against Soviet Jewry. I think I mentioned, he remained completely suppressive of Zionism and all Jewish cultural institutions in the Soviet Union. Nonetheless, at the United Nations, his public face abroad, I mean, you had Andrei Gromyko representing the Soviet Union getting up at the UN and said it would be wrong to deny the Jewish people the right to self-determination in the Middle East, and no nations in the world were able to defend this people from the fascist hordes in the last war, and this has to be done. It was clearly a political calculation, and so you have the strange scene of Israeli diplomats and Gromyko and Sarabkin and all the other Soviets meeting late at night. The Soviets always used to meet late at night because they are able to call Moscow at that time, and it works apparently. So all their meetings were around midnight or 1 in the morning, and planning together with the Israelis how they were going to frustrate the State Department, trying to frustrate partition and so on. It was a very strange period, which made the very strange bedfellows.
The internationalization of Jerusalem is still American policy.
It's still technically almost everyone's policy.
It's never been changed, but it's never been changed de jure. De facto, it has changed. When I was in Jerusalem in 1958 and on the GI Bill, I was getting my monthly checks to Jerusalem Israeli sector. Not Jerusalem, Israel. Today, or at some point in the past, but today you've been sent to Jerusalem, Israel. So the U.S. government
practice there was a bit of a change, and it might even have been marked in some official way, but you know, very quietly. For many years, Indo-America was opposed to internationalization at the time, and they argued against it, actually. But they everyone felt bound to accept it at the time. This was the time, by the way, this is a different world. This is when the UN said something, it meant something back in 49. We were talking about a body of 60 nations, not 185 like today, 189. Almost all of them were democratic. The exceptions were the five Arab states that existed at the time and the six states of the Soviet bloc. In other words, there was a democratic majority for just about anything, and it was able to work. And people at the time actually thought this might be the hope for, you know, the future of humanity and then world peace, etc. But that all changed over the years as, you know, the new nations came into being. They all tended to be dictatorships. The United States lost its majority in the assembly in 1958, and it's just been downhill ever since. But in those days, it had an impact. So the U.S. didn't oppose, in practice, as you say, the internationalization of Jerusalem. They just, the fact that they said, look, we're just going to leave things as they are. They eventually developed a protocol whereby their diplomats and ambassadors do go to Jerusalem. At first, the British insisted on sending their ambassador only to Tel Aviv and so on. The first Australian sent to represent Australia, they also presented his credentials to the president in Tel Aviv, not in Jerusalem. And there used to be questions asked if you were to go to Jerusalem, was it going to create an incident and so on. In the American case, I think America has come around to the viewpoint that West Jerusalem, which is lying within the pre-1967 lines, is Israel proper, and that internationalization is probably never going to happen. And as you know, the Congress years ago passed, approved the construction of an American embassy in West Jerusalem. But as you know, every administration since the first George Bush administration has given a waiver on that, has postponed the construction in the national security interests of the United States. It's been, in other words, a hostage to the successful conclusion of the peace process. And even with that collapsing in bloodshed and disorder 4 years ago, the policy hasn't changed. So that's where we are today. But it all stems from December 1949.
Can you sort of give us an idea of how this vote proceeded? Because you said on one hand the partition was approved at this subcommittee, and then of course
the General Assembly
approved it. And then you say that the American State Department, and I was aware of that, and other the loyalists, etc., at America didn't want the president to recognize it. So what was the United States and what were other countries doing? On one hand, were they voting for this in the United Nations and then weren't going to recognize Israel? Or
what? Yeah, no, it's not a straightforward story. Just like today, perhaps, America had not one policy but about two at any given time. There was the president's policy and there was the State Department's policy. And you see, what happened was this. Partition had been approved, but the one thing hadn't been approved was to enforce it. No one called for an international army to be created to enforce it on the ground, which is a great tragedy, by the way, because if it had been done, we probably wouldn't have the Arab-Israeli conflict today. There would have been violence, there would have been bloodshed, it wouldn't have been easy, there probably wouldn't have been peace for a decade or two, but you wouldn't have had the first Arab-Israeli war, you wouldn't have had the Palestinian refugees, it would have been a very different situation. So it was a tragedy. An important moment was lost. And it was lost because no one was prepared to enforce partition at the time. And this emboldened the Arab countries to get ready to invade Palestine. That too is a tragedy because many of them didn't really want to intervene. Egypt only decided a few weeks before the British departed that it had to because of popular opinion, which was inflamed by, you know, the international climate, where it was clear no one was going to lift a finger to see this implemented. And with that rising bloodshed and disorder in Palestine itself, the people in the State Department who were afraid of losing allies in the Cold War, Arab allies, etc., they came with George Kennan, who came up with this. You know, I think I've got his quote, his exact words here, actually, at one point. As they watch Palestine fall into disorder, he says, when and if the march of events has conclusively demonstrated that the effort to carry out the partition plan as prescribed by the UN General Assembly offers no reasonable prospect for success without the use of outside force, we should then take the position that we have been obliged to conclude, a very long sentence, that it is impractical and undesirable for the international community to attempt to enforce any form of partition. in the absence of agreement between the parties. So this was the thing they suddenly said, since the parties don't agree on partition, we're going to have to put the international army there to run things. And who knows what would have happened. It would have prevented Israel coming into the creation. That was opposed by a number of people, including Evers. And there was a lack of support to send an army to enforce the trusteeship as well. No one wanted to commit troops anywhere. So that also died, and that meant the British left, and the two parties fought it out with the results that we all know.
Yeah, well, you're the president of the Australian Chamber of Commerce here in Philadelphia. I want to support Daniel on the fact that Everett was absolutely the most boring speaker. The only conservative in the room, the rest were all Labor supporters. And after three quarters of an hour, when the whole room was thoroughly asleep, I decided to heckle him. I came out, and he went back like this. And he said, what do you want me to do? Get on with my speech or answer the question. And this whole hall of supporters screamed, answer the question. For the next half hour, he wandered on again, trying to answer my question. So, he was a terrible speaker.
And you're a wonderful speaker.
He's been criticized. Well, he had many people who disliked him. And they had very many, a very, very long list. One of his critics, or the man I actually met, Sir Walter Crocker, he was, when I met him, he was nearly 98. He died 2 years ago at the age of 100. This is a man who still worked with the League of Nations, not even the United Nations. He was an Australian-born diplomat. Very much, he hated Everett, and by the way, he doesn't like Jews either, although he said, you know, I was very nice to meet. And he called him, he had many words for him, he called him a wild colonial boy, a legal technician, a man of incompleteness and ugly paranoia. He systematically covered up his tracks. And what else did he say about him? I think it's a flavor of it.
Sorry, please.
Daniel, in the course of your research, did you become aware of relevant Arab archives? Did you have an opportunity to see them? Are you aware of any papers or archives that might add some other dimension to Evett?
Not really. The situation, there was one thing I unfortunately missed. Part of the problem is the Arab regimes that went to war and lost against Israel in 48-49, most of them were subsequently overthrown with a lot of bloodshed. I mean, the regimes in Syria, the monarchy in Egypt fell a few years later, and Nasser eventually came in. And there was a lot of beheading and the execution going on. A lot of people weren't around afterwards. And I wrongly assumed that they're probably all dead by now anyway, anyone who had survived. I later discovered I was wrong about one who would have been interesting. The Iraqi foreign minister survived the coup of 1958 in Iraq. He was sentenced to death, but for some reason they didn't kill him and they let him go and live in Tunisia in exile. And here I was thinking, then I opened up the Australian, which is sort of, you know, the New York Times of Australia, and I opened the obituary page about 6 years ago, and suddenly there's an obituary for Muhammad Fazil Jamali, who had died at 93, and I thought that was a great pity that I hadn't, you know, taken that extra step to look him up, because it would have been interesting. Evett knew him, Evett refers to him quite often, and he was one of the major figures presenting the Arab case to the UN. And almost certainly none of the others would have been around even 10 years ago, and certainly none today. As for archives, that's a different problem. It's sometimes a mistake to think the Arab archives are completely closed. The Jordanian ones, for example, are quite a bit open to researchers at various times. You can get good records of from the American archives of all the discussions the Arabs had with America. The American archives are very good. Every conversation an American diplomat had with somebody, there seems to be a record of it. There's huge amounts of this. So you actually get a sense of what the Arabs were saying. Quite a bit of this, and of course there's their own public statements and official documents, and there are some memoirs. But beyond that, I did not have a chance, for example, to go to Iraq and under Saddam Hussein and find out if there was still something in the archives in Baghdad.
But what about the parliamentary role, you know, for England, for...
Oh, yes. I did look at congressional papers here, the Australian parliamentary and the British ones. There's a great debate on the whole idea of recognising Israel in the British Parliament with Winston Churchill rising to heights of eloquence at the time. And I consulted these, and I mean, you know, I've used a lot of footnotes, so you can always find what I'm quoting if you want to pursue the story further. All you need really is a good library and a lot of time.
Yes.
What was Churchill's position on the formation of Israel? You say he made some speeches.
Oh yeah, Churchill was a long-standing friend to the Zionist movement. He'd been colonial secretary in the 1920s, and sometimes a lot of the things he did didn't actually help Zionism, but he was basically on its side, and he was quite clear about that. And in 1939, for example, when the Chamberlain government placed a white paper on Palestine, just at the very eve of the Second World War, they determined to keep Palestine with a Jewish minority, basically by cutting off Jewish immigration. They allowed 15,000 a year for the next 5 years. This is when hundreds of thousands are trying to get out of Europe. Well, Churchill came out against that very strongly as a terrible, dishonorable breach of contract, etc. And he pledged that once the war started, and the British were so frightened that they would be overthrown everywhere in the Middle East, he pledged at the end of the war, he said, we will not have this and then create a state with no further immigration, because that's what's in the white paper. We will rescind the white paper when the war is over. And during the war, he actually came up with a plan of partition for Palestine to be created at the end of the war. Unfortunately, that was shot down by the Stern Gang, the Jewish terrorists, because they assassinated Lord Moyne in Cairo, who was the British Minister of State in Cairo at the time. Lord Moyne actually was a very close personal friend of Churchill. Churchill had been a very close friend of Weizmann and the Zionist movement, but he knew nothing of this right-wing dissident movement. And he actually retreated from Zionism for a couple of years. He didn't come out against it, but he said, I can't deal with this. This is 1944, and he has the Second World War in his hands. And the cabinet came out against the partition plan because of after this assassination. And it basically meant that, and Churchill then lost office after the war, so it was no longer in his hands. Once in opposition, and particularly with Ernest Bevin trying to make as much trouble for Zionism as possible, he came out very strongly against the British trying to postpone recognition of the country. He said, we should cooperate, we should found diplomatic relations, it's a just decision, we've supported it for 30 years, we should be counted now. There's a great line in that parliamentary debate when finally it comes home to bite Bevin, because even his own party eventually turns against him. Is Britain persisting in this policy of not recognising an established country? They keep addressing notes to the Israelis, addressed to the Jewish authorities in Palestine. They won't call it Israel. Finally, there is a debate on the subject of whether they should act on recognition and efforts. I'm just looking for the a vital quote, if you'll hold me a minute, because it's sort of vintage of Winston Churchill. Let me just see if I can find it. Bear me a second. There's a whole debate in power. Bevin is blaming it on the Jewish vote in America, his problems. Bevin says, I have to be very careful what I say here or I shall be accused of disturbing relations with America. But in defense of His Majesty's government, I ask the House to realize that at this point the whole question of who should be elected to certain offices of the United States turned on this problem, and the United Kingdom had very little latitude after this time, and at least one British MP, a Labour friend of Israel, Richard Crossman, said, the point that there are so few Jews here that they can be safely disregarded electorally does not make us moral and the Americans immoral for having regard to the Jewish vote. And then Churchill gets up and says, I'm quite sure that the Right Honourable Gentleman, he's referring to Bevin, will have to recognise the Israeli government, and then it cannot be long delayed. I regret that he has not had the manliness to tell us in plain terms tonight that he preferred to retire under a cloud of inky water and vapour like a cuttlefish to some obscure retreat.
Please, Tom.
What part do you think that the Stern Gang is driven by the Christian state that you're
That's actually a very contentious question. I certainly think that the two assassinations carried out by the Stern Gang were a net loss to Zionism, if you're just doing a profit and loss account. Assassinating Lord Moy shot down the partition plan in 1944, which could have been, it wouldn't have saved any more Jews because the war would have been over by the time it was put into operation. But it would have happened earlier. And in 1948, they also assassinated the UN mediator, Count Bernadotte. Probably actually did Israel's reputation damage, but it actually probably didn't do Israel all that much damage because the man who succeeded Bernadotte was probably better for negotiating the ceasefire route, America's route punch. But in terms of the larger war, the Irgun and the Stern Gang conducting basically a guerrilla war against the British in Palestine, I think it was a contributing factor for the British to throw in the whole matter to the UN in 1947. Because it was the British had lost nearly 1,000 men in Palestine, mounting casualty figures, the country was becoming ungovernable, bridges were being blown up, telegraph offices hit, prisons had been blown up and the inmates freed. It was creating a great scandal. The British actually came back with repression, and this was getting Britain a bad name, it was getting Britain a bad name. It created a lot of international interest, especially with all the refugees still piled up in Cyprus and in Italy not being allowed to go there. It dramatized the situation of Palestine in a way that allowed action to occur at the UN, and as I say, it not happened in 1947. It may not have happened later because the international constellation would have changed. So it probably did have an impact. It probably did result in things happening when they did.
Did Everett ever visit the
results
of statehood, or did he comment on
what came out? Yes, he did. He did retain an interest in the country after. Let me just explain, on the very day that the UN voted to internationalize Jerusalem, passed his resolution, he and his government lost office in Australia in the elections. And Labour was to remain out of office for the next 23 years. He went into opposition. 2 years later, he became leader of his party. But he was not a successful leader, and the party actually split and remained in the wilderness for 23 years. He had such a promising career, and yet it ended in complete chaos and tragedy. He also later went mad, by the way, as well. So he had a very melancholy twilight years, and he never succeeded in getting to office. But in opposition, he did retain interest in the affairs of Israel. He depended, for example, the British came up with a scheme in the mid-50s that they're going to produce an Arab-Israeli peace treaty, but by sort of cutting Israel down to size. They thought the Arabs would go along with it. They wouldn't have, but the British had this idea, if you just cut enough slices off the salami, the Arabs would agree. And although some Australians were interested, like the Foreign Minister, Lord Casey, ever opposed it, he still found time to have sympathy for Israel in the Suez crisis when he took the view that Britain and France should not have intervened and attacked Egypt in league with Israel. And he did visit the country in 1958. He finally took up an invitation, but it had to be funded by someone. He didn't go there off his own bat. And in fact, I think the last picture in the book is him meeting with former Prime Minister Moshe Sharet in Israel in Bida, a much older man in 1958. So he just visited the country, and they also planted a forest in his name.
How do you explain that Great Britain, there were so many leaders who were Zionists, were in favor of a Jewish state, and yet, assigned George Wingate,
yes,
who organized the Haganah. So that had to be part of it, and yet the entire British government was opposed to it.
Yeah. At different times. They've been in favor at the time of the Balfour Declaration. Lloyd George and Balfour and people like Churchill and Leo Amery and other British politicians all been in favor. There was a swing against it. I try and talk about that in my book, actually. I wanted to give readers a background to 1947. I don't want you to open up and start there. I wanted some history of how things came to be at that time. And there was a few things in the air. There was appeasement, which meant appeasing the Nazi, the Axis powers in Europe, also meant siding with the Arabs because Britain's position in the Arab world was endangered. And they persisted in that policy even when appeasement failed, because now that they were at war with Germany and Italy, they needed even more friends in the Middle East. So the orthodoxy died hard. There were ideas that the Britain had shortchanged the Arabs, which they hadn't, over Palestine and other issues. There was a sense of imperial guilt that Britain had lost its way. And at the important time in government, unfortunately, if you like, the wrong people were there. Neville Chamberlain and his cabinet shot down the idea of partition in 1937 when the Peel Commission recommended it. It was the first commission to recommend partition. They imposed the White Paper. You had many critics in the House of Commons, including people like Churchill, who made one of his great speeches on the subject. But they were, he wasn't in command. And after the war, Churchill lost office, and once again, it was the British Labour Party. And although the Labour Party had been very pro-Zionist in opposition, it so happened that Ernest Bevin was not pro-Zionist. And the people who were pro-Zionist in the British cabinet, like Herbert Morrison and Richard Crossan, they were not in the cabinet or with the vital posts, the important positions. And Bevin was a very powerful foreign secretary. He was an extraordinarily masterful man, and a very popular one, in fact. Very much the opposite of Bevin when it came to working with people. People admired him, and he had a very strong personality, but he was dead set against Zionism. And once he decided on the course of action, you couldn't move him, so events had to move him.
Daniel, could you go back a moment to history with the history left out, because you mentioned Middle East studies.
Yes.
Can we talk just a second for people who don't know about Campus Watch and maybe just would you mind?
I
wait, and then we have room time probably for two more questions, but since you brought up Taylor's remark, I think maybe it's a
history room with the history left out. I said there's a lot of interest in all, now a lot of historians today who like to write more about theories and looking at things from a theoretical point of view, with interesting intellectual constructs, that doesn't make very much sense to someone who isn't a specialist. And sometimes into a specialist, you have to read it and you say, well, what's this all in aid on? Taylor was someone who was a brilliant writer, by the way, and he knew how to write a good story. He knew his documents well. He was an old-fashioned hack historian, he said. That's what he wants to be. And he didn't believe in history as the history left out. He believed it had to be written to make it readable. Today, when it comes to Middle Eastern history, there may be a lot of readable history. A lot of it, by the way, is also unreadable. But even a lot of readable is very much overlain with ideology and political commitments. I've never seen, less of an effort for certain historians to step outside of themselves and at least give a fair accounting, which will allow the reader to base themselves on the facts presented. Put it another way, I've often read books dealing with this kind of history where if you were totally reliant on that book, you actually wouldn't know all the necessary facts you would have needed to know in order to make a judgment of yourself. And that's where the bias comes in. And as we know, it's a problem today in academia as well when it comes not only to history but Middle Eastern politics. Many of the lecturers and professors in university, and I thought this was maybe just in Australia, but no, it's very much the case in America, I've discovered since coming in, are very much politically committed, normally to a very ideological left-wing agenda. Many of them are Maoists and Trotskyists and have a long history of association with these movements. The whole field is very much hostile to its historical inquiry generally. It's very hostile to different points of view. These people tend to be self-selecting. They emerged into the faculties in the 70s and 80s. They have stayed there, and the people they have recruited are people who think like them. Now, the people who think differently are very far and few between, very often old tenured professors who, when they go, I don't know who's going to replace them. And one of the things we do at Campus Watch is to critique and examine Middle Eastern studies in America by institutions and by personalities with a view to improving the conduct, the academic conduct. We look at several areas, political advocacy in place of scholarship, intimidation of students and other faculty with whom they may disagree, biased curricula, and issues of that kind. And I can assure you, we have our hands totally full. We could be working on this around the clock, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We haven't got enough personnel resources to look at every institution in America, all the Middle Eastern centers and all the historians, writing, and these days weblogs are very powerful, and writing blogs all over the place on the Middle East. And basically the scene is even more scandalous than I had expected. So this is the work we do on a very much a daily basis at the Middle East Forum. So if you believe that's something that needs critique, that we have to be the pioneers of doing something in that area, I so strongly suggest that you support us.
Thank you, Daniel. Two more questions before we wrap up.
Actually, a board member, you just haven't seen me 6 months out of the year. So. But we miss you. I'm curious, but I always love to place things in historical context, and we're trying to move forward in present-day Israel and Palestine and the whole partition. Where do you see the groundwork laid from this being applied today?
Well, that's a bit.
Then you have the whole UN that is not the UN, and who are the players in the UN?
Well, you're saying to apply the partition was a plan to have an Arab and a Jewish state in Palestine. It founded on Arab rejection back in 1948. The whole Oslo peace process of the 90s was really an attempt to restore it. It was the same idea. Maybe the borders would have been different, but the same idea, a Palestinian state and a Jewish-Israeli state. And that, too, is in tatters, and for the same reason. Nothing has actually changed. There were indications over the years, but I mean, to say nothing has changed is not technically correct. Over the years, there was certainly some kind of qualified emergence and acceptance of Israel. I mean, in the 1950s, most Arab diplomats wouldn't pronounce the word Israel. Most wouldn't sit in the same room with an Israeli, certainly not publicly. There was quite a bit of private diplomacy, especially with the Egyptians. But this wouldn't happen. There was a famous moment when Abba Eben was ambassador to New York and to the United States in Washington, where he appeared on a television program, and he managed to appear to, I think, the Egyptian ambassador. The Egyptian ambassador insisted that there be a partition built between them, that they're not sitting on the same set, which made very bad TV for Egypt. But this was the attitude. You would have an Egyptian minister saying that Israel should consist of only Tel Aviv. We'll never accept that. And that attitude changed somewhat. I mean, you can certainly get Arabs to pronounce the word Israel. But Egypt and Jordan have peace treaties, so they don't much, especially the Egyptians, don't much like the country, and they foster a great deal of incitement and propaganda against it. And the change certainly has not been at the level where it matters most, a change of heart, which would lead to an interchange to trade and economic and cultural relations and some sense of security. It's a formal, frosty, mean-spirited peace, and that's the best you can get at the moment. And with the Palestinians, you can't even get that, because it depended on the Palestinian movement legitimating Israel by making peace with them. That's the one thing Yasser Arafat was never going to do. He was not going to fulfill the role that had been assigned to him. Well, that was one issue, but I would wager that if Jerusalem had, let's just say they'd agreed technically on paper to that, then it would have been the right of return. It would have been something else, but it wouldn't have happened, and it didn't happen. And it's not an accident that it wouldn't happen. And therefore, I think we're simply in the mode not of finding peace treaties at the moment. We're in a conflict management mode, and that takes years. And unfortunately, the situation has gone back, because 10, 12 years ago, Palestinians had a relatively diverse press. They were, many of them had no love or interest in Arafat. Some were pro-Jordanian, some were more independent. Well, the first thing Arafat did when he came to 94 to Gaza was to close down systematically the papers and the independent voices and the Palestinian media. And within 10 years of indoctrination, the first thing he did to the textbook was to put back everything the Israelis had censored on Jews and Israel, etc., from the Jordanian and Egyptian curriculum. That's made the most poisonous educational literature in the world. Now, with a whole generation indoctrinated, I fear we're another generation off before we can actually offset the damage that has been done during the 1990s.
One more question. Anybody? Yes, thank you, please.
Yeah, I think you had characterized American historiography
You're talking about the history of the 48-49 war?
Yes.
Yes. In the late 80s, a number of Israeli historians and publicists calling themselves the new historians, I speak about it very much only in passing in the book, but it is relevant. They came along to say that they had a new version of the history of 48 and 49. Israeli archives had been opened, under the 30-year rule, and now all the papers were available, including the Israeli army archives. And the man who made the most of the new documentary crop was a man called Benny Morris. There were others too, and he wrote the book, the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem, or the origins of the Palestinian refugee problem, which was quite widely accepted at the time, because he was quoting documents and he was doing it comprehensively across the board. And there are others who came to say, by the way, the argument of these people is simply that the matter was not quite so black and white. Israel missed opportunities to negotiate with the Arabs when the Arabs put out feelers. And they were determined to have a state of certain borders, so they were inflexible on some points here and there. Another historian called Avi Schleim came along and said, well, actually, Jordan and Israel collaborated to prevent the Palestinian state from coming into being. Well, there's a few things about this. Firstly, some of these theories were actually not all that new. There have been other people who come along with them for quite a while. The idea, by the way, that the Israelis had at various points in the war driven out Palestinians was also not new, but this was played up. In fact, a lot of this history was defective. Firstly, it turns out Benny Morris needs some elementary lessons in quoting documents. He, strangely enough, misquoted documents, but very often considering them the opposite to what they were saying. They were wrenched from context, and apparently Frank Karsh writes the authoritative account of this in his book Fabricating Israeli History. He thought this was strange because he remembered one document, not as Morris said it. He went back to the archive. Then he started going through all the papers, and he presents alongside what Morris says with the documents as he found them. And you have here, therefore, a very politicized view of this. Now, why this happened is not hard to guess. You had a period where many people were thinking Israel doesn't need the territories. It's time to make peace. It's secure enough. And the Arabs are pretty much willing, maybe. Why don't we get together and even say history wasn't quite so one-sided either, and this will contribute to peace and reconciliation? Well, we've had 2000, we've had the Oslo War, and we know it doesn't actually work. It actually seems to morally disarm the Israelis and embolden the Arabs to ask for more. Benny Morris himself seemed, without actually rejecting anything he ever said, has come out now saying that he always believed actually the Palestinians were never going to accept the viability of Israel, and we're against the state and that they mean to destroy the country and so on. So he's persona non grata with the pro-Arab school of thought. But the fact of the matter is, this was to a large extent defective and sensationalist history. Some of it was true. A great deal of it hasn't really changed our understanding all that much. It's maybe filled in a bit more detail, but things were pretty much as we knew them to be before. Basically, that there was a war, the Arabs insisted on it, that the Palestinians wrecked for a number of reasons, some of which were due to Jewish military action, most of which were due to the Arabs and their leadership calling on them to simply leave and get out of the way of the fighting, in the belief that they would be coming back after an Arab victory, which never transpired. And that version really hasn't changed.
Thank you for a fascinating. I think Daniel would really like to find a copy of this.